Welcome to a podcast called Intrepid. My name's Craig Forces. I'm here with Stephanie Carvin, once again high above the Rideau River at the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton. And today, Stephanie, what are we doing?
Well, we're talking about four things. We're going to get an update in the Abdul Razak case, which we talked just briefly about last week. We're going to talk about a peace bond that wasn't. We're going to talk about citizenship and national security, because this seems to be something in the headline. And we want to, you know, highlight with a little bit more nuance than perhaps what's been discussed on Twitter, which is always, you know, the best place to get your informed commentary. And then finally, notwithstanding anything else, we're going to look at the notwithstanding clause and national security, since that's also in the headlines.
Yeah, so we're gonna cheat a little bit in this episode. Typically, when we talk about topics, they're squarely national security topics that have come up in the news. We're expecting a deluge of national security topics probably by the end of the month. But in the meantime, we're treading water a little bit here. And what we're doing is we're extrapolating from events that are in the news that have a resonance from a national security perspective. And along the way, this is our effort to unpack some of these public policy and public law issues that might be part and parcel of them. And I have to note that Stephanie deserves extra credit for participating, because she's got the traditional academics fall cold.
Yeah, we called this frosh flu. I sound a little bit more resonant, but Craig's going to be doing the heavy lifting today. I'm going to be like, wow, that's a good point. Please speak more. So that's where we're going.
Hopefully you'll feel better for next week, which is next Thursday when we record is Speak Like a Pirate Day.
I know. Avast. It's going to be great. Okay. So I'm going to muster what's left of my energy and sanity to start off with Abdul Razak. What's the latest?
Okay, so I'm not going to rehearse the saga here. We talked about it a little bit last week, but just a short version here. Mr. Abdul Razak, Canadian of Sudanese origin, detained in Sudan by the Sudanese, maltreated, alleges maltreatment at least. The issue was that he couldn't come back to Canada because he didn't have access to a passport, nor was he able to fly because he was listed on a blacklist by the UN, the 1267 list. Lawsuit was brought in federal court to oblige the government of Canada to facilitate his travel and provide papers so that he could do so. He was ultimately successful in that venture. This was almost a decade ago now. However, along the way, the federal court concluded that the service, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, was complicit in terms of his detention. And not surprisingly, upon his return, he's now sued civilly the Canadian government for just less than $30 million. The lawsuit has not settled. It's going to trial. And as we said last day, this is one of those few instances in national security where a civil matter is going to full trial and doesn't settle. And we anticipated last week, recall, Stephanie, that this, we're turning into a verb now, circus. It was going to circus.
Yes.
Well, it's circusing.
Circusing.
So one of the issues, and it will shock no one who listens to this podcast, one of the issues always in these court cases involving national security is going to be disclosure. Now, the onus here is on the plaintiff, that is Mr. Abdul Razak, to prove some malfeasance by the government in a tort, or in this case, I'm sure he's suing also for a constitutional breach, which is now compensable through damages. But the issue then is the onus is on him to prove this. And so extracting information from the government is very, very important to serve this onus of proof. And of course, what's at issue is very sensitive national security information. And so we've had this redaction, re-redaction, re-redaction, the prospect of a Section 38 proceeding under the Canada Evidence Act to protect information the government doesn't want disclosed, all these sorts of things that we've talked about from time to time. Well, the issue is that we're still there. We're on the eve of trial, and apparently we're still having bun fights over disclosure issues, which is surprising this late in the proceedings. But
is it, though?
Well, I mean, that is a good question, because, of course, one of what's notorious about the closest analog to this case, which would have been the case involving Mr. Nuruddin, Mr. Al-Mahdi, and Mr. Al-Malki, the three individuals whose maltreatment was the subject of the Yakabuchi inquiry over a decade ago now.
They were in Syria?
Syria, Egypt.
Yeah.
And so there, the Commission of Inquiry concluded that there was some responsibility borne by the government in that case. They sued. That case was notorious for being salted earth on these procedural issues, lasted well over a decade, ultimately settled fairly recently. We talked about it in a past podcast.
And not uncontroversially.
And not uncontroversially, although not the real controversy was the settlement with Mr. Khadr.
Yes.
So the issue is that, is this kind of a modus operandi? The state will continue to use procedural motions and dispute over disclosure to stave off adjudication on the merits? Or are we ever going to get to the merits on this case? Now, the one wrinkle that we're anticipating here, which is really interesting, So the state, that is the government, wants to protect the identity of former and current CSIS officials and officers who are going to be witnesses. And so presumably they're going to want to close the court for that purpose, which is novel. It's not impossible, but it's novel. But I'm told also that the government will be moving to create essentially what's known as a closed material proceedings, which is available in the UK by statute, which allows the merits to be adjudicated ex parte, that is, with the government side alone with the judge, and the other party is excluded, which is...
So in other words, it would just be the defense?
If it's a true closed material proceedings, yeah.
Okay.
So the judge would be privy to information that at the time it's never been tested. So that's actually would be a remarkable trenching of the open court principle. It was an issue raised by the government back in August of 2017 in a discussion paper. Mm-hmm. The government view on this is, look, there's a lot of non-meritorious cases where if we're to defend ourselves, we'd have to elect to disclose information that's prejudicial to national security. And so we end up with these cases where we're caught in the horns of a dilemma. This is this issue of graymail that we talked about the other day.
Sure.
And so we need a system where we
can... As opposed to blackmail.
Well, but it's called graymail, right? I mean, it's right. kind of this murky... It's not illegal. It's just kind of a strategy. So we need some kind of intermediary system where we can have a closed court and provide this information for the judge so the judge hears our side without having to release information that's prejudicial to national security. But the countervailing value is, well, but that's not a fair trial because our system is predicated on adversarial challenge.
So one thing I've learned on this show is we have to be really careful about importing U.S. concepts into Canadian courts. And often you hear in the U.S. system this process of discovery. Yeah. Where like basically you sue someone and then the person who's, you know, can actually kind of fight back maybe in a graymail kind of way of basically saying, okay, well, I get now all your documents in order to defend myself. So the process of discovery in and of itself is actually a deterrent to run a case. So that's
what's it's same thing. It's discovery
same thing.
Here.
Okay.
So it in a criminal.
We don't call it that. We call it disclosure.
We do call it. Well, in a criminal context, we tend to call it disclosure. In a civil context, we'd call it discovery.
Okay.
So it's the same issues are in play. The rules on scope of discovery in a civil context aren't as broad as they would be on a criminal context where we've talked in the past about Stinchcomb.
Sure.
But there's still an obligation or still a capacity on the part of the plaintiff to sort of reach in and extract information through a process of discovery. And so the acute issues in terms of, you know, scope of disclosure, the consequences of closing the trial, the implications of a judicial determination are different on a civil side than they are on a criminal side. Because on a criminal side, it's a true David versus Goliath. It's a defendant who's being prosecuted by the state and possibly
doesn't
go
have
to
the
jail.
Resources of the state, right? Yeah.
So here, I mean, there is a resource imbalance, but at the end of the day, no one's going to go to jail. And so the stakes aren't quite as high. It's a monetary stake, nor are the disclosure rules quite as robust on the civil side. And so, you know, so you can think about, I mean, when I think about this, first of all, I'm really concerned at the idea of closing courts so that it's ex parte in a civil proceeding because, you know, our system is predicated on an adversarial system.
Right.
On the other hand, I mean, I understand the government's dilemma, right, that you've got these non-meritorious cases, at least in their eyes are non-meritorious because they've seen all the information and they want to preclude the prospect of these frivolous cases going forward that they have to settle because they can't defend them without imperiling national security through disclosure, right?
So before going ahead, we basically have to kind of solve this other issue of whether or not you can even have a closed court.
Yeah, and so there are issues as to whether you could legislate it in this space. And that was one of the proposals from August 2017, and it went nowhere. And, you know, there's a couple of reasons why it might go nowhere. The issue as to whether the court, on motion by the government, outside of any kind of legislative imprimatur, could unilaterally carve this sort of system out of its own inherent jurisdiction. I haven't researched the question, but that's surprising.
Mm-hmm.
From the government's perspective, I suppose, if you're the government, you're sort of either you win, in which case you've got your closed material proceedings, or you lose, in which case you turn around and you say, we need closed material proceedings because there's no other way that we can proceed. So we need to legislate in this space, right? So, you know, I don't see a doubt from the government's perspective. There's no downside in making this motion because they win either way to
right.
come up, either win on the merits of this case in the sense they get a closed material proceeding, or they win sort of a policy argument that we need to move legislatively in this area, or at least it enhances the idea that some kind of legislative corrective is needed. How would it work if you did have closed material proceedings? At the very least, you need to superimpose, it seems to me, that you need to borrow from that special advocate model. Right. And so
from the UK special advocate or our
model, right? So that you would at least not have, you wouldn't abandon the idea of adversarial challenge. You would at least have
someone
security
there
cleared who's lawyer cleared, who's yeah. duty bound to present the alternative perspective and advance the case of the plaintiff in this case who's been excluded from the actual proceedings.
So we don't have special advocates in civil proceedings.
Nor the only place we have special advocates by matter of law is with immigration security certificates, by extension other immigration inadmissibility proceedings.
Okay.
They're not mandatory there, but they can exist. We have used the equivalent of special advocates, but we call them something different. We call them amicus. They have a slightly different role.
Wait, no, but not the mascot of the Supreme Court.
Not the mascot of the Supreme Court. Okay, right. Amicus curiae, friend of the court.
Friend of the court, yeah.
Who's essentially retained by the court in one of these closed proceedings, say under Section 38 of the Canada Evidence Act or a particularly complicated CSIS warrant application to provide that adversarial balance. So it's not just a judge themselves sitting there in splendid isolation with, the CSIS witnesses and the government counsel.
Okay.
So, wait
so
and
all
see.
This to say is basically what, like not unlike actually other national security cases, the one we talked about last week, the Chinese spy case. We're still fighting over evidence and what can be presented. And
so we'll wait and see. I was expecting to start hearing on the merits. I mean, the witnesses are all prepped by mid-month, but who knows if that's going to happen now.
Okay.
Okay.
So we move to the peace bond
peace
that wasn't?
Peace bonds that wasn't. Right. So you and I certainly encountered this case. It was Rachel Brown from Vice who ran an original story in July.
Right.
Which was really confusing. So this is an Ottawa case. And this individual, the government was proceeding with peace bond against them. It was a classic fear the person may be affiliated with ISIS. It was presumably to preempt travel.
We've talked a lot about peace bonds last season in particular.
Right, so we're not going to try to rehearse what a peace bond is, but basically it's a constraint on liberty short of incarceration. It's like a restraining order, basically. While the government was proceeding against this individual for the peace bond, I understand that they actually had started the proceeding. This person was arrested and charged with shoplifting from a liquor store and assault with a bottle. Right, and so there are conventions.
We all need hobbies. We all need hobbies. Joining ISIS, robbing a liquor store.
Yeah,
same
although
thing.
The two might not be, if you're trying to finance your travel to ISIS, it's not unheard of. And we have had one case where knocking off the corner store to finance your trip to ISIS was, in fact, part of the pattern.
Do we know if the person was trying to rob the store or was it shoplifting?
So I don't know that this is, I don't mean to infer that in this case.
Yeah.
I've not seen a link drawn between the two, although I'm not familiar with the case record. But the bottom line is there were conventional criminal charges that were brought against this individual,
right.
Which sort of obviates then the need for a peace bond, right? Because it's like Al Capone light.
Yeah.
You can proceed against them for conventional criminal code offenses that could put them in jail, which is something a peace bond never could. So what's happened just yesterday, and so it's Stuart Bell who reported on this from Global, and thank you, Stuart, for sending the actual probation order from the court. But so he's not going to go into jail, this fellow. There's a court-imposed probation order, and the terms of the probation order are quite interesting because they're the sort of terms you would expect in a
peace bond,
an anti-terrorism peace bond,
right?
So not to leave Ontario, not to possess objects with the ISIS logo, or view materials that advocate or support the use of violence or espouse extremist or radical views, not to communicate with anyone supporting terrorist activity, or, and this one's interesting, or anyone believed to hold radical religious views. All right, and that one I paused on. I said, well, first of all, what the heck does that mean?
Yeah.
All right, and second, recall in one of the conversations we've had in the past with peace bonds, and this was an issue for Mr. Driver,
yes.
Aaron Driver, The Manitoba Provincial Court concluded that it was not possible to superimpose a peace bond that required religious counseling.
Yes.
And it was the decision is not persuasive in the least, but that there was a constitutional issue here. And the reason it wasn't persuasive is they didn't look at the most plausible constitutional right, Section 2, freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of religion. But rather they looked at Section 7 of the Charter, which was really quite strange. But the bottom
Section
line
seven
is...
Section 7 being?
The protection against threats to life, liberty, security of the person.
Right, okay. That's bizarre.
Deprivation without fundamental justice of rights of that sort. But so right away I'm thinking, well, that's interesting. And then there are a large number of conditions that talk about counseling. Psychiatric counseling, taking meds as instructed by doctors and psychiatrists. And so the terms of the probation order are very invasive. And you recall our past discussion, I wasn't persuaded by the Manitoba court's conclusion that it would be constitutionally impermissible to make these requirements, at least not without further analysis. And here we turn around and we find that this probation order includes quite invasive expectations of this individual in terms of the sorts of things that were animating the objection by the Manitoba court.
So I have a couple questions here.
Yeah.
So the first would be, the difference here, though, is a peace bond is pre-crime, where this is post-crime. So does that make a difference?
It could.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's an important point. So here we've got someone who's has committed these criminal offenses. Now, of course, the issue, of course, there is knocking off a liquor store and assaulting someone with a bottle. I mean, so what's the correlation between that and having an ISIS flag? Right. So to a certain extent, you kind of see this as a disguised peace bond. Now, it's a 12 months duration, by the way, much as a peace bond would be. So, I mean, I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's anything necessarily legally wrong with this. But like I say, I see this as Al Capone light.
Just getting the guy through.
Yeah. And so they've abandoned the peace bond. The other limitation, by the way, is access to the internet, except as required by the employment under the supervision of the probational officer, which is also a very standard feature of a peace bond in an anti-terrorism case. So interesting development.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've talked about this before. There haven't really even been that many peace bonds recently. I think this is the first one to crop
really
up in some time.
Off.
Yeah. So this and even then, it's a peace bond that wasn't. So it'll be interesting to see if this actually happens more in the future. But I mean, it doesn't slightly off topic, but it doesn't surprise me that someone who is involved with the Islamic State or might be influenced by that ideology would also possibly be involved in crime and or alcohol. These are not separate things at all. So, I mean, I don't know enough about this particular case, whether or not the person was shoplifting alcohol for himself or whether he was actually just trying to rob the store. It's not clear, but these are not mutually exclusive things.
Well, and another
slightest.
Issue we've talked about too is mental health issues, right?
Exactly.
So to what extent?
Yeah, the counseling.
To what extent was this person, given the terms that are imposed here, one has to believe that there's some kind of record.
So many of these guys are not winning at life.
Right. And so to what extent was this person posing a genuine national security risk / plausible individual in terms of traveling, the complicated process of traveling to Turkey, to Syria, which now, of course, is even less likely given the circumstances on the ground there. To what extent was that plausible? Or is this just another case, a little bit like that BC case? Remember that BC case we talked about a couple of podcasts ago at the end of last season?
Oh, where the individual, they use the pictures and the...
Right,
yeah.
So, again, you know, there's this conflation of... Is this an ideologically motivated individual or is this a person who for other reasons picks up on something that's notorious and in the news?
Yeah.
Why don't we move on then?
Yeah. Okay. So something completely different. Citizenship.
Yeah. So the reason we're talking about this, Stephanie, is there are two reasons. We've talked about the Vavilov case, right? I think we actually talked about it.
The Russian spy kid case.
So again, we're not going to rehearse those facts, although they'll have to come up in part during our conversation. But so the government's now in the Supreme Court on the Vavilov case, and recently in argument in front of the Supreme Court, so in its filing, indicated that public international law does not oblige everyone who was born in Canada that they automatically get citizenship.
Right.
Which is true.
Yeah.
And we can talk about that in a second.
And by public international law, you mean just like basic international law, not private international law.
Yeah, so the treaties, custom international law.
Yeah.
That got picked up in the media as being viewed as inconsistent with the condemnation that certain members of the Liberal government directed at the Tories for their resolution at their convention.
Yes.
Which was aimed at eliminating birthright citizenship. That, you know, someone who's just here and on a passing basis who has a child, automatically that child is Canadian. So the way that it's played out, at least in social media, is that, look, there's hypocrisy here. That on the one hand, you're saying international law doesn't require that everyone born in Canada become a Canadian, and on the other hand, you're condemning this motion. And I'm not quite sure how that got conflated in the public mind, but I thought what we could do is sort of unpack why there are certain policy and legal differences.
Well, there's a Canadian press story about it that I thought, you know, didn't actually even talk about the merits of the Vavilov case and what that was. I thought it was a pretty bad story that was out there.
Right. Yeah. So I think that probably helps fuel some of the conversation. But just to be clear here, so international practice, there are basically three ways you obtain citizenship.
Right.
One's called, excuse the Latin, but jus soli, that you're born on the soil, you're born in the territory. Jus sanguinis, you're born of a citizen.
Right. So these are the blood.
This is
right?
What I think people have been calling birthright. So birthright by territory, birthright by blood. And then there's naturalization, of course.
Yes.
Emigration. Incoming immigration. And so all those are valid. And states to varying degrees employ either one or other of those or a mix of those. Canada happens to use all three. And that's a choice. The issue from an international law perspective is there's no obligation to use any one or other of these. There's no obligation, for example, to have jus soli. no obligation to have jus in genus or no obligation to allow naturalization. It is entirely at the discretion of the state. And this goes way back over 100 years in some of the jurisprudence of the predecessor of what's now known as the International Court of Justice, saying that the issue of nationality is a reserved domain for the state. It's not governed by international law. And the more modern instruments, human rights instruments, don't really change that. They do, to a certain degree, guarantee a nationality. And there are international instruments that preclude statelessness, although even there are exceptions. And there are international instruments that say you, in giving nationality, you can't discriminate on the basis of enumerated categories like race or religion or et cetera. But that's not to say that the particular means by which you give nationality, whether it be blood, territory, naturalization, that you have to have that full roster or, you know, pick amongst them. So to be clear here, this is a policy decision made by the state. And one of the policy decisions we made in Canada, and you can look at the Citizenship Act, is again to allow these three processes and have been very, very generous in terms of the understanding of jus soli, born on the territory. And so if you're born on the territory, and the Citizenship Act acts a bit of a muddle, right, because it's meant to accommodate sort of different iterations of the act over time and the segue from the British system to the Canadian system. So it's a bit of a muddle. But bottom line is if you're born on the territory, you're a Canadian, subject to one exception.
Yes.
One important exception. And that exception is the one that's at play in the Vavilov case. And that exception is if you are the offspring, the child of a foreign diplomat or employee, so an employee or diplomat of a foreign government, then you're not entitled to citizenship because you were born here.
Yes.
And the exclusive issue in the Vavilov case is, what does employee mean? Does employee include an undercover agent, an illegal, to use the term correctly, an illegal, that is a non-declared...
Someone who's here, yeah, non-declared spy, basically.
An intelligence officer who assumes Canadian identity and has children here in Canada while assuming that identity. Is that person an employee of a foreign government? And the Federal Court of Appeal said no, right, because of a statutory interpretation exercise. And I think also a bit of a misread of international law, I have to say, with all respect to the Federal Court of Appeal. And so that's the issue that's going up to the Supreme Court. That's different, though, than the issue as to whether the state could change the constraints it puts on jus soli. And so if in fact, a future government wished to say that in order to be a Canadian, yes, you can be born here, but thereafter you have to show some connection to the state, perhaps you have to spend at least five years here if you're born to a non-Canadian, etc., which other states have done. There's nothing wrong there. It's a choice, a policy decision.
Choice, yeah.
Now you can debate the merits of that policy choice, and there are reasons not to prefer it. By the way, the fact that you had to demonstrate some other attachment to the country beyond birth would mean that we could no longer use our birth certificates to get our passports, right? We have to demonstrate something else. I don't know what that would be. And administratively, it would be very, very complex. But the bottom line is that these are quite different policy issues. The policy issue at issue in Vavilov is, should the children of spies be entitled to Canadian citizenship? And the policy issue with the Tory motion is, are we too generous, generally speaking, with jus soli, that is, citizenship by virtue of birth? And you can have different views on that, right? But they're quite discrete issues.
This isn't like to endorse one or the other, but just to clarify. Yeah, it was a very frustrating Twitter conversations, but at least, you know, the good news is about terrible Twitter conversations is that you get to have a pretty good podcast set up.
Yeah, well, and I guess the other background issue too, from a policy perspective, do you want to be the country that undercover agents can go to and therefore forever their children are entitled to citizenship?
Yeah, I think there's a real danger here. And I don't think the Federal Court of Appeals consider that at all. Like, what is the risk here? Like, Russia, China suddenly sending tons of illegals to Canada in order to get citizenship. Because it's a lot of times, and I think this is we're saying that a lot of the time during the Cold War, and I think the McDonald Commission actually picked up on, not the McDonald Commission, one of the earlier commissions in the 1960s, they looked at this issue because they noticed that a lot of illegals would get Canadian papers and then go off to other countries.
Which is exactly what happened here.
Or the United States,
right.
Exactly.
So in the Vavilov case, which is the genesis of the Americans TV show, Canada and then moved to the U.S., they were ultimately caught in the U.S. and removed back to Russia in exchange for, amongst others, Mr. Skripal.
Oh, Mr. Skripal, that's right. Yeah, yes. Yeah, totally.
The victim of the attack, chemical weapons attack in Salisbury.
Oh yeah, and by the way, those two Russians appeared on TV today saying that they were just interested in seeing the steeple.
The Salisbury Cathedral, which is an amazing cathedral, which includes one of the original copies of the Magna Carta, which I'm sure was the attraction.
Yes, because you know, if there's something we know about Russian spies, they really, really like the Magna Carta. Anyways, but yeah, all this to say is that, like, you know, I think there is a, you know, that even the 1960s, like, you know, commissions picked up on the fact that, you know, this actually endangers Canadian documents, right? Like, this affects all citizens. If you can't trust Canadian documents because, you know, we have this high rate of illegals, and by which I mean illegal spies, then this is actually a really bad national security problem. Yeah. So, I mean, the fact that this was ignored in the Federal Court of Appeal case to me is problematic.
You know, in fairness to the Federal Court of Appeal, it's not their job.
I'm not going to be fair to the court.
It's not their job to make policy. It's their job to apply the law. Now, in fairness also to your point, the law is sometimes a bit of a mug's game in terms of understanding its scope, and statutory interpretation is never an exercise with only one outcome, and let's put it that way. And so construal of this law to say that employee does not reach an undercover agent of the state, well, it's difficult to see on the plain reading of the statute. The court purports to find justification in the legislative history, purports to find justification in international law, which is the part I doubt. Bottom line, though, if the court at the Supreme Court chooses to follow that same line of reasoning, it's open for the government of Canada to turn around through parliament and legislative change that makes it very, very clear that employee includes non-declared employees who are assuming Canadian identity.
Right. I mean, the Supreme Court got beer wrong. So I have no hope that they're going to get this right either. So,
well, I mean, I think from
it's going to be open season. They'll have to introduce some kind of legislation, I think.
Probably, but then the question is whether they could ever strip. So if Mr. Vavilov enjoys citizenship under the current Citizenship Act, because the Supreme Court concludes the Federal Court of Appeal got it right, and you know he's a citizen, could you retroactively strip him of that citizenship through legislation? And I have to say that's a novel issue. He had a bona fide citizen under the Citizenship Act. Can you then take that away?
Didn't they try that?
Well, so in terms of revocations, the revocations we have on the books right now are for fraud. So a lot of people actually say war criminals can have their citizenship taken away. Well, no, that's actually not what the law says. The law says you can have your citizenship taken away
if you've lied at the time
you acquired citizenship, you lied about the fact that you were a war criminal, in which case it's just fraud, much as if you lied about whether you were a terrorist or a criminal or any other kind of fraud or misrepresentation. If you acquired citizenship through that misrepresentation, the point is, it's like a contract, right? If I sell you swampland in Florida that doesn't really exist, and there's a fraud at the basis of our contract, that contract is voidable.
Are you saying my reading week vacation plans are now void?
Right. Well, not void, but voidable, right? That you can choose to cancel that contract. So if I acquire citizenship through lying, then it's under the arrangement we have at present, we're free as a society under the act to say, well, you don't get to keep it, which is quite different from saying, you got it, it was fine how you got it, now we're going to take it away from you as a punishment.
Mm. Which is what they're doing in the UK, I think.
And which is what the Tories included with the citizenship revocation for terrorists that were part of the Citizenship Act, which were repealed early in the Trudeau government's mandate over the last, I'm not going to say mandate, that'll get Philippe Lagazé very angry during the early years of the Trudeau government.
Right.
So, and similar issues, right? So there you were taking away citizenship of a terrorist who was bona fide a Canadian at the time, and you're taking it away essentially as a supplemental
because
punishment.
Because of something he's done.
Right.
Subsequently,
right, which is very different
than someone who gained it through fraudulent means.
Who never really had it in the first place.
Right.
Okay. So...
So, notwithstanding
all of this, clause. Right.
Let's talk about notwithstanding clause, because we should be very clear. We're not going to talk about this at all in reference to Ontario, except for just the fact that that's how it came up. And I asked you on Twitter, have there been any cases of the notwithstanding clause used in an emergency scenario or in a national security context? And I guess, you know, one of the reasons I asked this was, one is I couldn't think of any. And then secondly, you know, it's funny, I do sometimes simulations in our class, particularly on pandemics. And it's always like hour one, revoke the charter. Like, wait, whoa. It's not how this works. You don't revoke the charter in hour one of a pandemic simulation. And then we have to go through why that is. So, but that got me wondering, like, so when and how is this used in some kind of national security emergency context?
Well, you're right. It hasn't been used in that context, in part because we've never had an emergency of that scale and scope. We've never actually used our regular Emergencies Act, which is we've talked about from time to time in the past. So you know, one of the issues with the conversations we're having right now about the notwithstanding clause in the charter is, and I think we're guilty of this in the law school, and law schools generally in the way we teach constitutional law. Our problem is sometimes we teach constitutional law as a grab bag of provisions that are shaped by jurisprudence. And we don't talk about the Constitution as a system. And so we never approach it as a system that has a history.
Right.
Rather, it's just the latest jurisprudence from the Supreme Court. So if you approach it as a system, then you can have a serious conversation about where the notwithstanding clause lies in terms of how that system operates and how it might operate in an emergency situation. So just for those who don't know, notwithstanding clause, Section 33 of the Charter, it says that certain rights, I want to underscore that,
Two and Sections 7 through 15.
Correct.
Right.
Of the Charter can be suspended, I'm going to use the term suspended intentionally, by the legislature, so by Parliament or the provincial legislatures. So for every time that someone says, Trudeau should do the notwithstanding clause, well, no, it's not the executive's choice. It requires legislation that has to be
passed.
And in the federal context, that would mean passed by the House of Commons, passed by the Senate, given royal assent by the Governor General. That you have to go through that process. And in that process, you have to specify that you're using the notwithstanding clause with sufficient precision, name the rights that you're now going to preclude or limit.
Yeah, notwithstanding clause, section. There's
procedural requirements, and that notwithstanding provision only endures for 5 years. So you can only suspend for 5 years. Now, you can renew, but to renew, you need to go through the legislative process again.
Yes.
So the idea of sunsetting is that if you have some aberrant government that on a lark of its own were to invoke Section 33, well, 5 years, what's the magic of 5 years? There's at least one election that's happened since.
Exactly.
Right. So, because the longest duration of a parliament constitutionally can be 5 years.
Yes.
So another parliament will have a chance to reconsider whether it wishes to re-legislate the notwithstanding clause. All right. So one of the issues that's come up in the discussion is, well, is that all? Well, pretty much. So do you need an emergency? No. Do you need an exigent circumstance? No. Do you need something that's potentially
life-threatening?
Yeah. Right. No. Gibb Van Aert, who's a very talented lawyer and wrote a very good book about international law in Canadian law, and is recently the executive director at the Supreme Court of Canada, on Twitter today made a very interesting observation about the extent to which some of the constraints on derogation from international human rights law might inform how we apply the Charter Section 33. And that's a very good argument, but it's not been established.
By that you mean like, so if you have international law, you can derogate from it.
Yeah,
you can say that, in other words, we're not applying this, we're not doing this under some international law, right?
Right. So that we also, as a country, are bound by international human rights law. And so the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and there's a derogation provision for, again, certain rights that allows you in exigent circumstances where it's an existential crisis with notification to other parties to the convention.
We're going to suspend certain rights. Yeah.
All right. And so there are further constraints, right? Yeah. Constraints that are tied to that existential crisis. And so Gibb's thought was, well, to what extent would that inform how a court might police use of Section 33? And that, as you might predict, animated all sorts of discussion on Twitter. A novel issue. It's never been decided, in part because Section 33 has been used so rarely and has never really been challenged. It did come up in a case called Ford at the Supreme Court with the sign law in Quebec. So the issue is, well, are there any other checks or constraints in the Constitution in an emergency situation? Because if you've got a legislature that's capable of suspending rights, could you not wake up one morning and find yourself encumbered with the War Measures Act again? And so the War Measures Act, famously
nobody
used
expects
in the October
the War
crisis,
Measures Act, right?
Right. So a sweeping delegation of power by Parliament to the executive that, in the event of a war or insurrection, real or apprehended, the government could basically do anything. And it also suspended an earlier rights instrument known as the Canadian Bill of Rights. So the War Measures Act was the basis for the Trudeau Pierre Trudeau's intervention in the October crisis in 1970 in Quebec.
Right.
Widely viewed as an overreaction. Could you end up with an enactment in a modern emergency where Parliament enacted the equivalent of the War Measures Act and suspended the Charter.
So the Emergencies Act?
Yeah, well, the Emergencies Act doesn't suspend the Charter, right? It anticipates operation within a Charter framework.
No, but if you were going to pass the
if you were going to say, look, the Emergencies Act isn't good enough, we're being invaded, we need something that's much more sweeping, could you pass such a thing and like your students wanted to do,
yeah,
suspend the Charter? Well, yes, you could.
Maybe I'm a bad prof.
Using Section 33, right? And yeah. So it is a very powerful instrument. And so at the end of the day, even with the sun setting, is there any other check on it? And ultimately, it's a political check. And the political check, one of the political checks, is that Section 33 does not reach Section 4 of the Charter, which constrains the duration of a parliament. Mm-hmm. And so it means that you cannot suspend the duration of a parliament. You cannot extend it using Section 33. However, you can, if you get a two-thirds vote in parliament, in a time of insurrection, war, real or apprehended, you can extend the duration of a parliament.
Huh.
Right? And so then what's the check on that? Well, the only check there is that you got to get a two-thirds majority.
And that would be pretty hard under our current system.
It would be a very rare government that had a two-thirds majority with a single party.
Okay.
So I think that's all we really have time for, Stephanie. I know this is really a technical discussion.
Notwithstanding.
But you asked me to do the heavy lifting.
I know, because
there was always a risk that it would involve Latin.
There's an emergency in my brain, which is apparently run by thousands of germs that are trying to gain citizenship up there. So let's call it an episode, and we'll be back next week.
Yeah, we'll hopefully be back with stuff that's quite current and is cropped up in the news.
Sounds good. See you then.
Bye-bye.